Does the Second Amendment community and other right-wing conservative types need a new foundation or a new mythos, so to speak, to support their belief systems? That's what we're going to be talking about today. Welcome back to another episode of T-Rex Talk. On this podcast, we have talked an awful lot about the need for foundations and standards and having a true north. In fact, we beat that drum quite a bit, specifically me. There is a need in our community and the United States at large for more unshakable convictions, but convictions need anchors. If they're going to be actually unshakable, they have to be attached to some immovable things, some foundations. And this podcast is going to be about somebody who agrees with me, although we probably couldn't disagree more on where those foundations need to come from. I was reading an article by Richard Hananiah, who is not someone that I generally recommend, but he is one of these right-wing-ish commentators, one of the new rationalists on the internet trying to figure some of these things out, even though he has changed his position on a bunch of stuff. Tech community people read him. Like, he's a very smart guy. But let's get into what he actually believes. Well, this article doesn't get into that so much, but it has a bunch of his initial presumptions in it. The name of the article is Building a Mythos for the Non-Christian Right. And this is a very important topic for us to discuss within the gun community or the Second Amendment community or whatever it is that we actually want to call ourselves. And I'll get into that in a minute. But let's start with the opening of his article. He lays out a couple of presuppositions saying conservatives have their own intellectuals, but those on the right cannot primarily rely on a belief in the good sense of our elite institutions and how the marketplace of ideas currently operates to validate their opinions. They therefore often seek solace in religion. So right off the bat there, good observations on the elites. Academia is pretty far left. Journalists, when you look at how they donate to political causes, 90% of them donate exclusively to Democrats. Politicians themselves are generally more 50-50-ish, but the bureaucracy within the government, very left-leaning statists. Ideologically, very opposed to conservatives, which we'll get to that label too. However, I'm going to disagree with Richard Hananiah on one point, because moving from conservatism to religion is backwards. It is the religion of Christianity that produces the worldview. You don't just go picking and choosing religions that will support the opinions that you already have, even if your experience with the world may drive you toward certain conclusions. Whenever people convert to Christianity, say, because they think it lines up with some preconceived notions that they have, well, that doesn't go nearly as well as when people convert to a religion because they see the emptiness of human solutions and they are willing to humbly adapt their worldview to the truths of the religion. And going back to the article, he continues to write, "If you are neither a leftist nor a Christian, you need to look elsewhere for inspiration. The ancient world beckons. The fact that there was a Western civilization before Christianity, no matter how long ago, indicates that there can be one after it." And most of the ideas that are in this particular article are not his. He's reviewing a book by a gentleman named Costin Alamariu. He's a Romanian guy, so I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name. And he recently published a book called Selective Breeding and the Birth of Philosophy. Now, Costin is an even weirder character than Hananiah. His online handle is Bronze Age Pervert. But this book that he's published is his PhD dissertation. So he's a very interesting and kind of strange dude. And he has changed his positions over time, just like Richard has. So these are guys who have been, in the past, blown about by various winds of doctrine. So they definitely demonstrate the need for a foundation. And that is exactly what Costin's book is about, and Richard Hananiah can see that very clearly. He writes, "I realize that the point of the book and the BAP, Bronze Age Pervert Project more generally, is to create a mythos for the non-Christian right. He did not write and publish this work simply to express his views on questions of purely historical interest, driven only by a curiosity towards the subject. Rather, the goal here is to discover, or one might say construct, an intellectual and spiritual genealogy for the Nietzschean right. I must leave to classicists questions regarding whether his arguments are actually true, but one thing I can say is that the larger effort they are a part of is desperately needed. So here's part of the reason that the non-Christian right needs a foundation. So progressivism is moving away from the old. It doesn't really require a specific goal. It doesn't really require a lot of coordination. Moving away from the old is something that you can do just by destroying the old. You don't actually have to create, have a new specific goal that you're going to get to with mere progressivism, with mere leftism. And then conservatism, mere conservatism, I would say, seeks to preserve the old. But that's not super clear. That's really really fuzzy. There's so much old stuff that is worth preserving, and there's a bunch of old stuff that isn't, and then there's all these different periods of old. So are we trying to get back to the 1950s? Are we trying to hang on to stuff that we had in the 1980s? Conservatism needs a foundation to preserve stuff, if that's all that you are doing. And then, yeah, the lack of a foundation causes issues when conservatives want to do stuff together. So far with this article, I completely agree with the needs that Hananiah is seeing, but I completely disagree with the way that he is getting there. And this is the first kind of major point that I want to raise an issue with. When he says, I'm not sure if these arguments are true, but they are desperately needed, this is a problem. This shows that he has a presupposition that truth is going to kind of, to some extent, be determined by the need. If the facts don't support the theory, construct a new mythos that will serve to support the theory. And building a new foundation out of nothing in the middle of thin air is folly. And I haven't read Costin's book. I am not going to. But it seems like that is, in fact, what he is doing. He's going back to Plato. He's going back to Aristotle. He's reading a whole bunch of Nietzsche, and he's kind of trying to rearrange everybody's thoughts and kind of make them agree with his position to create this argument from authority, this argument from antiquity, this idea that his ideas have been around for a long time and they created everything that is important. And so that can be the foundation for the non-Christian right. And this is certainly not the first time that this has been tried. Now, hear me very clearly on this point, because I try real hard not to call people Nazis lightly. There's way too much of that nowadays. I am called a Nazi. If you've downloaded this podcast, you possibly will be called a Nazi. But I want to talk about some actual, honest-to-goodness Nazis. The Thule Society was an occult group that was created inside of Nazi Germany by high-ranking Nazi officials in order to do exactly what the Bronze Age pervert is trying to do. Create a mythos for the Third Reich. Create some sort of pre-Christian history that was grand, that was glorious, that would buttress all of their claims about Aryan superiority and give them some kind of, you know, scientific, academic fuel to the fire. And you possibly have heard about the Thule Society because they're in a whole bunch of movies and video games and comic books. This idea of Nazis opening up portals to other worlds and finding supernatural elements throughout history and searching for these things is just part of our comic book legend. It's in Marvel, it's kind of in Indiana Jones in a tasteful way, and then obviously Hellboy and Wolfenstein and all sorts of different things have played on this idea. Now, the Thule Society did not actually open any portals to other realms and bring old ones across or any nonsense like that, but it was a very real society, and they tried very hard to build a fake history. In addition to their occult stuff that they did that was real, they did a whole bunch of historical research that was not real. They were really focused on this this myth, this source of the magical superior Aryan. They searched through all of these different documents and came up with these insane theories about Hyperborea, Atlantis, some sort of foundation for this Aryan philosophy, some sort of pre-Christian civilization that would prove the superiority of their ideas. And it's not something to laugh at, but I do think that it's kind of funny that in their effort to create an alternative history, they basically failed. But they have made themselves the source of so many fictional alternative histories in pop culture. I just think it's a slightly funny. Another example would be Wakanda. Wakanda, the fictional African nation that was invented in the 60s by some white guys, also at Marvel, also comic books. And man, Wakanda is just kind of a cartoonishly bad cultural appropriation of African stereotypes. And today, Wakanda is kind of supposed to be this beacon of African exceptionalism, even though in the comic book they got all of their cool stuff from alien gods, not actually African tradition. We live in a very interesting time where co-opting fiction, revisionist fiction, is almost as powerful and as important as revisionist history. So grab some pre-existing fictional character that has value, that has cultural cachet, and twist that to your own ends. You know, turn Star Wars into a feminist polemic. Destroy all the Harrison Ford characters in all of the franchises. Make every comic book hero gay or some other kind of subversive thing. Actually, we should do an episode on the comic book industry because it has pretty much destroyed itself in a way that is, you know, appropriately for the comic book industry, I would say, completely over the top in an almost supernatural fashion. But let's get back to real life. In real life, the desire of the Thule Society, the desire of a whole bunch of different sociologists and anthropologists, a whole bunch of internet commenters today, and the two gentlemen that I'm talking about, this idea where you will take a historical society like the Norse peoples, and you will take their cultural paganism and you will try to elevate it to something that it never was. And this is sort of problematic in a bunch of different ways, because most of what we know about these pre-Christianized cultures was recorded and preserved by Christians. I could get more specific, but a lot of these cultures had no written language. Some of them did. A lot of the Northern European tribes did have runes, but these runes were used for magical ritualistic purpose and kind of a separation of the clergy and the laity, so to speak, a way to keep secret knowledge in the hands of druids or something like that. There was very little written historical record at all, and most of their culture was preserved in oral traditions, which change over time, until Christians came along. And as soon as Christians came along to document what they were doing, they also began converting all these pagan tribes in Germania and Scandinavia and England and Ireland. They all independently were doing missionary work, and they were all independently documenting these pagan practices. And in the process, they were replacing their pagan theology with Christian thought. And as soon as that happens and you see widespread conversion of these pagan tribes, you see this massive explosion of agriculture and population expansion and culture and art and technological advancement and medicine and cities and castles and cathedrals and, you know, nations that actually lasted for 1,000 years, unlike, you know, that thing that the Thule Society was trying to do. But today, that very clearly documented, very, very obvious thing is under fire from a bunch of different sources. There are anthropologists today who have a new theory that Christianity did not change Germany, but that Germany changed Christianity. They reject the idea that the Christian missionaries like Boniface and Methodius and Columba saved European people from this bloody backwoods tribal barbarism, even though, you know, it is super well documented. There's this new idea that European tribes swallowed up these Christian leaders, totally subsumed them, and totally overwhelmed their theology with good old pagan brutality and child sacrifice and slavery. And even though there's no evidence of this, that is what created this explosion, this boom, this hybrid syncretism is what created Christendom. And I actually understand exactly why this is happening. You have to know more stuff than just that that surface level history. You would have to know something about the history of Christianity, because if all you know is modern Christianity, you will think that Christianity is powerless. If you see, you know, a modern iPad flannel wearing pastor sitting on a stool and just kind of rapping with his audience for 15 minutes, giving a devotional that has no devotion in it, you would know that that kind of Christianity is not capable of sending men into Teutoburg Forest to chop down the sacred oak trees and turn them into churches and fortified abbeys. You would know that that kind of Christian is not capable of doing hand-to-hand battle with the same berserkers that sent the Roman legions packing. And if you know your history deeper than some sort of surface level, you would also know that some of these guys are just getting stuff really wrong. The Teutonic Knights that they lionized were not Ostrogoths. They were not barbarians. The 400 men who defended Malta and slew hundreds of thousands of Turks did not do so because they were the pagan berserkers, but because they were defending all of Christendom from pagan invaders. And this is where we get to the Second Amendment, guys. This is super important for us here in the gun community, because the Second Amendment is a fantastic anchor. It is a fantastic place for us to really require a foundation, because it is a perfect intersection of self-defense and private property and personal responsibility and legal jurisdictions and limited government and an exploration of where rights even come from. It is a fantastic anchor, but you have to anchor it somewhere. Is the Second Amendment just a good idea? Is it part of your Viking heritage? No. Did imaginary Spartan warriors invent it? No. You've got to understand the history, because you've got to get some good shelves to put these things on. And I know people that don't really have the shelves. I know guys who believe that a whole bunch of secular humanists and deists moved to America so that they could do whatever they want. And then they read a bunch of Locke and Paine and Hobbes in the 1770s, and then they decided no kings, no masters in 1776, and then they just stacked bodies until 1780s, and then everything in America was good and perfect until the 1980s. When Jerry Falwell injected Christianity into politics for the first time in history, and it's all been downhill from there. And if you believe that that is historically what happened, then yeah, it would be logical for you to assume that Christianity is dumb and bad, and those red-blooded, red-pilled frontier anarchist chads were super based, but those guys are imaginary. And I also know guys who believe that Christianity teaches you that you must turn the other cheek no matter what. You must bend the knee to whoever, and you need to just make yourself into a doormat and never offend anybody no matter what, and never take your beliefs out of your own head, and never apply the Bible to anything outside of the church building, and then only on Sundays. And these guys are super offended when Christians don't do this, because they put them in a box, but they're also super offended when Christians do this, because it's incredibly weak and cowardly. And the worst part is that the Christians that these guys are imagining are actually not imaginary. There actually are Christians like that, and there are churches that teach that. There is legitimate criticism of the modern American church. But the problem is that it is losing its foundation in Scripture, not that it's no longer syncretized with paganism. If the church has lost its true essence, then obviously it needs to get back to that true essence, not just blend it with other stuff. And Hananiah doesn't really understand Christianity. Let's go back to the article. He says, "The role of ancient philosophy in the Bronze Age Pervert Project is to provide inspiration for those of us who reject both Christianity and modern leftism, the latter having dispensed with all the supernatural elements of their faith while holding on to the worship of weakness and a contempt for the body." Let's stop right there. Yes, The weakest churches are those that have abandoned literal readings of Scripture and have abandoned all the supernatural stuff that is in there. But this this contempt for the body is not something that is historical Christianity at all. Christianity teaches that your body is not your own, that it is actually a temple of the living God. The Old Testament is just packed with really chad and base-pilled, for lack of a better word, scriptures about building up your body, training your fingers for war, being able to run on a troop and leap over a wall and stuff like that. Exactly the sort of thing that the guys writing these kinds of articles love from the ancient world and are completely ignorant of when it comes to David's Psalms. Then he goes on, "There was once a world that unapologetically recognized that some individuals were better than others and had an appreciation of the intoxicating effects of physical beauty and masculine courage. It can exist again, at least that is the hope." So that is Richard Hananiah's hope. But you gotta have a foundation to even define what courage and beauty is. If you look at pagan cultures throughout history, they did not have those definitions in common. Beauty is not a constant concept. And some of these cultures, their languages didn't even have words for courage or honor or nobility. So if you look at the things that pagan cultures did have in common, this idea that some people are better than others, absolutely, I would say that's pretty universal. And if you take that to your logical conclusion, some people aren't even people. And that is why you can have slavery and theft and sacrifice, because might just makes right. And if you look at the comments on some of his articles, you can see that Hananiah's readers are almost universally pro-abortion, pro-euthanasia, and pro-eugenics. So some of these very common universal pagan elements definitely would resonate with them. And they tend to want somehow these magically pure bloodlines to come back. But ironically, they do want the hybrid vigor of some blend of Christianity and Hellenism, or some mixture of Christianity and paganism. And they talk about these ideas as if they have never been tried, as if there's never been syncretism in the world. But you can actually read about these things in the Bible. The syncretism of Judaism and Hellenism is something that you see already by Acts 6 or 9, I forget. And even this idea of talking about the ancient world through a Christian lens or vice versa has been done, and it's been done way better than these guys. Tolkien is a perfect example of this, someone who loved the ancient world and the ancient literature and the ancient tropes, and he created the Lord of the Rings series to put those things on Christian shelves, which works way better than the other way around. You cannot put Christian virtues and the fruits of the Christian spirit on the pagan shelves. But what Tolkien did is very interesting. And this reminds me that I don't have his translation of Beowulf yet, which I should totally get. But Beowulf is a very interesting concept. To this day, scholars do not really know exactly what Beowulf is. Is it a pre-Christian pagan myth being retold by a Christian chronicler? Or is it kind of a conglomeration of pre-Christian pagan ideas that are being reformed and articulated through a Christian worldview by a Christian chronicler? Or is this something that early Christians in that part of the world were doing and talking about, if these were their stories that are being written down by Christian chroniclers? Because remember that Christianity does have words for beauty and for honor and for courage. And there are ways in which the Christian missionaries that went into those places are far better at recognizing and truly honoring their opponents and loving their enemies and converting them and documenting the things that were truly honorable about some of these pagan leaders. And there are people like Boadicea and Vercingetorix who are worthy of honor in very specific certain ways. The Christian culture is capable of discerning these things, you know, taking the meat and spitting out the bones, so to speak. So if you do want to delve into the ancient world and you do want to find things that are worth emulating, you have to have some sort of filter and some sort of lens. Otherwise, you get things backward, which I think Richard Hananiah is. He says here, "Of course, the ancient virtues never went away because in part They speak to something deep in human nature, and particularly Western man. Now, this is partly true, depending on how you mean it, because all man is sinful, desiring power. That is why there are a lot of universals across pagan societies. But at the same time, all men are made in the image of God, and they have some sense of His law on their hearts, which is why you can find fascinating stories in ancient history, even amongst some of the darkest and most primitive pagan tribes. But even though a lot of us have in our hearts this impression of God's law, the way that most men deal with it is actually rebellion. And that is why you see a bunch of people who are absolutely hell-bent on finding alternative mythos for their political ideas, in the 1800s especially. So you have the French scientists after the French Revolution desperately searching for some kind of Egyptian mysticism to replace the church in their country, even though they already had the cult of reason. Darwin is a good example. He was searching for an alternative creation myth to replace Genesis. Marx was creating an alternative economic system to replace God's economy. And Nietzsche, very carefully and deliberately trying to produce some sort of alternative philosophy that would replace God's reality. And that's really hard to do. The easiest way to get around that is just to go insane, which Nietzsche did. But Nietzsche is a really good example of this this trend where these post-Christian men always want to find some kind of alternative pagan tree, but they really, really want it to grow that Christian fruit. So Nietzsche is constantly bashing Christianity's slave mentality because man needs powerful tyrants to lead humanity into the future. But he wants these powerful pagan tyrants to preserve free market economies and inculcate the appreciation of beautiful art and to build strong independent families and all of that sort of thing. It's a terribly poor understanding of paganism and the ancient world and Christianity itself. And when internet commenters, these new rationalists, the non-Christian far right, when they try to pick up Nietzsche's mantle and run with it, you can see that they actually have a terribly poor and shallow understanding of paganism and the ancient world and Christianity. They almost all of them believe that Christianity began from scratch, out of nothing, in AD 33. They completely ignore all of scripture that existed before and all of the influence of God's people prior to that. And they believe that civilization began really early on in some sort of pagan center or ancient Greece. But they're really ignoring some really cool, vibrant, rich, actual history that they should be aware of. For example, I'll recommend a book to you as a historical curiosity called The Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, which contains in it really accurate, detailed nautical maps from times when ancient peoples were not supposed to be globally seaworthy. And some of the most convincing, fascinating maps are maps of Antarctica, where the coastline matches the actual geographic coastline, which has been covered by ice for hundreds and hundreds of years. We only know where it exists because of our ice-penetrating radar. But at some point in the very distant past, some people actually charted the coastline of Antarctica pre-ice and pre-when modern historians think they should have been able to do that. And some of the sociologists and anthropologists who believe in these ancient seafaring societies do things like Thor Heyerdahl built a raft called the Kon-Tiki so that he can demonstrate crossing the ocean on some of these ancient vessels was actually possible. People laughed in his face because that's just not acceptable. And ironically, this is Darwin's fault. This idea of social Darwinism says that cultures always go from primitive to advanced. And so everybody pre-us has to be considerably more primitive. And there shouldn't be anybody who is able to cross the ocean on boats and navigate well and chart things accurately that early on. Even though there's just a lot of evidence the other way. For example, in the Southwest United States, you can find something called the Decalogue Stone, which appears to be carved by ancient Phoenician sailors. And I should point out that these ancient Phoenician sailors are not pagans because the thing that they carved on the rock was the Ten Commandments. And when you look back through really fascinating ancient empires, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Persians, you have so much history and there is so much documentation of their civil organization and their religious literature that really should be delved into. And I will make a point that the God of the Bible is not absent from these ancient kingdoms. It is true that in the Old Testament, you don't have the same Great Commission that is in the New Testament. When Jesus told his disciples to go into every nation, teaching all that he had commanded. And yet, the Israelites in the Old Testament, who had his law, were supposed to tell everyone about it. And one of the things that happens is you have periods like under Solomon, when all the kings of the earth, which is probably a little bit hyperbolic, come to visit Israel so that they can learn from his God-given wisdom. Or times when Israel is in exile. The greatest emperor of the greatest empire in history was Nebuchadnezzar. And multiple advisors of his at the very top of his administration were not just captured Israelites, but prophets of God. And Nebuchadnezzar actually sends out edicts proclaiming the God of the Israelites to be the sovereign authority on earth. And amazingly enough, he is actually humbled to the point where he writes a chapter of the Bible, which is still kind of mind-boggling when you think about it. So this idea that we have to ditch all of this incredible, amazing, vibrant history that is just so fascinating to consider and reveals so much about the ancient world and human nature, just so we can invent a mythology that supports an alternative to Christianity, is laughable. And that's just kind of where things are at on the internet right now. The left has gone so completely bonkers that there's a whole bunch of people who just don't want to go that way, and they must have an alternative. They must have another route. But I will say that at this point, even the labels conservative and liberal don't mean a whole lot. Even left and right are kind of, I would say, not super helpful directions. It's time for us to get back to some moral absolutes and talk about right and wrong, or even just truth and lies. Is it true that the ancient world supports non-Christian civilizations flourishing in the same way that Christians do? Is it true that the pagans were actually more effective at civilizing and providing for human flourishing than the missionaries who changed their societies forever? Or is that just a myth that we have to believe because we must have some kind of alternative? And to answer that question, you can't just have a bunch of fuzzy theories. You cannot just have brutal utilitarianism. You must have actual standards.